which is the effective action for the free field, for the interacting field. So remember, we had a theory which was described by an action, and I was in the Euclidean formalism, so I had an Euclidean action S of phi, where phi was a scalar field. So it was an application from space time, which is Rm4 to R. And we showed that I could define an object which is the effective action for the quantum theory. Effective action, gamma of phi for the quantum theory, where now it is a function. So this is a quantum field, if you want. At phi of x is a classical object. It's a classical background field. Okay, and basically, phi of x is the expectation value of the quantum field, of the quantum operator at point x in some state of the theory, which is obtained by adding to the action of the theory a source term. Okay? So phi of x, this classical field, is the expectation value of a quantum field. And this object will describe how the properties of the quantum theory depend on the expectation value of this quantum operator. So this is an expectation value of a quantum operator. In a vacuum of the theory, well, in some state. Okay? And we have seen that this effective action has the following properties. In particular, we have seen that its minima, so if you look for an extrema of the effective action of phi of x, so this is, if you look for an extremum of the effective action, you get a solution. Let us call it phi 0 of g. And this is just the expectation value of this in the vacuum, in the true vacuum state omega of the quantum theory. Okay? And so now I want to do a warning. Last Friday, I said something which was blatantly wrong, in fact. I told you that one interpretation of the effective action could be that this effective action could be written as the expectation value of the classical action of the theory, considered as a quantum operator, in a vacuum, in a state, such that phi equals phi of x. Okay? In fact, that's not true. It's just the first term of an expression. And there is, in fact, another term, which is proportional to h bar. So you don't see it in classical theory. And in something which, it's something which is related, if you want, it's something which is the entropy of the quantum fluctuation. Okay? So the definition I wrote first, which was that gamma of phi equal integral over d4x of g of x, phi of x, minus h bar logarithm of the partition function of the quantum field is correct. This is correct, but this relation was incorrect. I forgot these terms for some reason. Okay, so my apologies. But all what we did was using this formula, and therefore all what we did is correct. Okay? So now remember that from that we have derived, we did a calculation at one loop, yes?
Yeah. Are you calling H bar the entropy, or is the term in
quotation marks? No, no. H bar is Planck's constant. It's what's happening here. And this is the H bar times the entropy. Okay. H bar is not only. So this is when Z object is defined simply as the path integral over all field configuration of exponential of minus 1 over H bar times S by minus 2 phi. Okay, so this is H bar. Okay, so remember finally that we did a calculation at first order. Yes?
S, the expectation value of S, is that in the vacuum state?
Yeah, it's in the vacuum state defined by this action. In the vacuum state, with G different from zero. See? Remember, we start from a theory with an action. We modify the action by having this term. So the Hamiltonian of the theory changes, so the vacuum state of the theory changes, and depends on G.
But everything, all the expectation value you've written here is in a state where J is not zero.
Yes. Here, everything. The vacuum is G different from zero, and here, in fact, this equation amounts to G of X equals zero, because G of X is defined by this equation. So looking at the minimum of the effective potential amounts to set G of X in the original theory. And therefore, this object should correspond to the expectation value of the field operator phi in the vacuum state of the theory when G is equal to zero. So this is a true vacuum state, and this is something that I can call on the ground. That's another state in the Hilbert space, which is the vacuum of the theory, where when the Hamiltonian is modified by adding this term. Okay, and so to come back, at first order in H bar, we did a Gaussian, we did a specific integration over the field configuration phi of x. Remember, we try to compute this path integral formulation, or this path integral, or this functional integral, at first order in H bar. We saw that it was possible to do it. This was simply a Gaussian integration, and we ended up with a very simple formula, which was that the action of the effective action is just the classical action of the theory, the original classical action, plus h bar over 2 times something, which is just the trace of an operator, and this operator is the logarithm of another operator, and this operator is the operator whose kernel is the second derivative of the action. And then we have higher order term in H bar that I've not written, but we have this very simple and very general formulation. So now what I want to do today is to apply this result to the 5-4 theory we started from. So for the 5-4 theory we started from, the original action is, remember, I am in Euclidean space-time. This is so I can write it that way, plus m squared phi plus g over 24 phi 4x. Okay. So this is the Laplace operator. Delta is minus d over dx mu, d over dx mu. Okay. So then, and I am in Euclidean space. Okay. So what does this very general result give if I am considering
the this action. So the second derivative of this object means that I'm taking two derivatives with, so now I am computing S of phi, of course. I am replacing capital phi by little phi, but that's exactly the same function. And I want to consider what is the second derivative of this object. So the second derivative of this object, S, is just an operator whose integral kernel is the functional derivative with respect to a variation of phi at a point x times the functional derivative of this operator with respect to a variation of y at a different point of this action s dot of phi. Pardon? No?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay, so here is the integral kernel, so let us call it s dot phi of xy. Okay? But if we do this, we can do easily the calculation by taking two derivatives. So if I have this is a Gaussian term, so that's something we already computed for the free action. Therefore, let us write it in a compact form. If we take two derivatives with respect to phi here, what do we get? We just get this differential operator, minus Laplacian plus m squared. Okay, so that's the result of the free field. So that's a differential operator acting on functions. Okay, so now we have to compute what is the effective action, what is the functional derivative for this object. So I take a functional derivative with respect to one field, and I get a phi cube. And then I take a second functional derivative. I get something which is non-zero only if x equals y. Yes?
Pardon? Is there a delta function missing? There needs to be some y dependence in that. Okay. Here, I am writing it as an operator.
Okay? Which means that if I am interested in writing its integral kernel, it will be simply minus Laplacian plus m squared, where I take the derivative with respect to x times delta 4 of x minus y. So you see, that's the same object here written as a differential, as an operator acting on function, and in that case it's a very simple operator because it's a differential operator. It's okay, and here it is written in terms of its kernel. Okay. So now, what do we get if we take two derivatives? Of course, if I take two derivatives with respect to the field phi, I get g divided by 2 phi square of x. Okay, so this is an operator which is minus two derivatives plus m squared, and this is an operator where if I have a function, I multiply it by the function phi square of x. In other words, in terms of integral kernel, this is phi square of x times the Dirac function of x minus y. So this and this are two ways to write the same object. Pardon?
And there
is a, oh, yes. Thank you. Okay? You see? So, this object, considered as a differential operator, is not that much complicated with respect to the cut of the free field. Simply, we have two derivatives, and then we multiply, instead of multiplying the function by m squared, we multiply it by a term which depends on the position of the space, because it depends on the source term. Okay? Okay, so now let us compute this. Let us compute what does it mean to take the trace of a logarithm of this operator. Okay? So the trace of the logarithm of this operator, well, I can rewrite this operator simply as the trace of a logarithm of minus the differential operator times the operator identity plus the inverse of this differential operator minus delta plus m squared applied to the function g over 2 phi 4. Okay? So, what I've been doing here is I'm just factorizing the operator for the free field. Okay, and that's now remember that in general this operator and this operator do not commute. So in general you cannot write that the logarithm of an operator times another operator is equal to the logarithm of the first operator plus the logarithm of the second operator. That's in general not true for operator. What is true for commuting numbers is not true for non-commuting quantities. But this, we take the trace, and remember that the trace of the log is just another way to write the log of the determinant of something. Okay. So in fact, we are computing the logarithm of the determinant of this operator times this operator. And remember that we know that the determinant of the product of two operators, A of B, is always equal to the products of the determinant of two operators. That's true for any matrix. So let us assume if the determinant makes sense that it's true for any operator. And this means that in fact we can write this as the logarithm of the determinant, and the determinant, we have the logarithm of the determinant of this operator times the determinant of this operator, and now we have logarithm of numbers, so the logarithm of a product of two numbers is the sum of the logarithm. So we can rewrite this as trace of logarithm of minus delta plus m squared plus trace of the logarithm of this big operator, 1, that's the operator identity, plus this operator, the inverse of this operator, times g over 2 times phi squared. Yes. Okay. You see? And now I can make a perturbative expansion in G, the coupling constant, which is there. Remember, here we have the coupling constant. Because I know, so we are dealing with operators, so we are dealing with matrices, but logarithm of matrices are defined as logarithm of numbers, and therefore we can just use the Taylor expansion of the logarithm. This is logarithm of 1 plus something which is small if g is small. So we just use the Taylor expansion of logarithm of 1 plus x, and we end up with, so we have two terms. First we have these terms, and then we have this term, and I will concentrate on this term. This term, you see, this term is equal to sum from k equal 1 to infinity of g over 2 to the power k minus 1 to the power k minus 1 divided by k time trace of k times the products of this operator, and let me rewrite it in a compact way. So I rewrite this as an inverse. Phi squared. So I get this operator to the power k, and then I take the trace. Okay? And finally, we have to think about what is this object? What is this? This trace. Remember? Okay. So we know what is the integral kernel of this. The integral kernel of phi squared is just the function delta of x minus y phi squared of x. The integral kernel of 1 over minus Laplacian plus n squared, we know what it is. We have derived it in studying the free field theory. This is just the Feynman propagator in Euclidean space. Therefore, it's just the Fourier transform, remember, of 1 over k squared plus n squared k times x minus y. Okay? And what does it mean to take products of this operator? It means that you take the convolution of g of this integral kernel with this integral kernel. Okay, so this trace here can be rewritten as, I just write it in yellow, this trace can be rewritten as simply, the trace is the integral over some point of the matrix of the kernel of this object with this object k times. So what is the kernels of this? This is g of x1 minus x2, let us say. Okay. I want to compute the kernel. The kernel of this is the g of x1 minus x2. Then the kernel of phi squared is phi squared of x2. Okay. Taking the product means simply that I... What's happening? Sorry. Okay. No, but I've not yet activated the second, the screen.
No, I just want to make sure that it's going.
Ah, okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, if I take the products of this with this, it means that, in fact, now I am integrating both over x1 and x2. d4 of x2. Okay, then I am multiply this by the same object. Now it's g of x2 minus x3, phi square of x3, etc. Until I arrived at the last term, which is g of xk minus x, some k plus 1, times phi square of x. I'm sorry, that is phi squared of, no, that's it, k plus 1. Okay. But then I take the trace, which means that I identify xk plus 1 to xk. So finally, I get, for this object, just an integral over the whole space, the products over the position over of n points of d. 4 of xi times these products. with here, it's 1. So this is, if you use the definition that I gave you before, what is the product of two operators, namely the fact that the internal kernel of the product of two operators of x, y is just the integral of a d4z of a of xz, b of z and y, and that the trace of an operator is just the integral over the diagonal matrix element of the kernel. So if I use those two properties, the definition of kernel operator and what is the product of kernel operator and what is the trace, you end up with this simple formula. Yes? Pardon?
L is 1.
Where is there an L?
Yeah, 1.
Pardon?
Yeah, the GK minus F 1 at the end. Looks a bit like an L.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's 1.
That's 1. This is 1. Yes, and this is 1. Okay. And here I integrate for the whole position of. So I have k points here. So I have k propagators. So you see, I have k propagators. And k pi squared.
Yeah.
Yes?
Xk plus 1 is equal to xk.
Pardon?
Xk plus 1 is equal to xk.
Or x1, I'm very sorry.
This is k points.
So, yes?
I had a question. So this is probably not relevant for the lecture, but I'm curious. You said that these two operators don't necessarily commute.
Yes.
Now, I can understand a differential operator acting on a Feynman propagator.
Yes.
But how is a Feynman propagator acts on a differential operator? That's it. So that ordering is fine. I can understand that.
Well, think of this as functions. Those are really distribution, but those are simply functions. And this is the very definition of the product. So,
right.
So you see, you can, if you have some the Feynman propagator acting on a differential operator, means simply that I take on the right this Feynman propagator, on the left.
Right.
I take this object, which is in fact a distribution, and then I integrate boldly in over the position of the points, and in fact by using the rules of integration by parts, this always makes sense.
Right.
You can always, if you have a differential operator acting on the distribution and you don't like it, you integrate by parts, and the integral operator acts as a function which was on the left. So, in fact, this is perfectly well defined mathematically. And the result is very simple. You see, because simply now we have convolution of product of functions times simple local function, which is phi squared of, at a given point, x. See? So, finally, and I will write this here, we end up with. We end up with the fact that the effective action gamma of phi is given by the, so it's given first by the classical action, so it's given by the integral of the d4x of 1 half of phi of x times minus the Laplacian plus d squared phi of x plus over 4 5 4 6, that's the classical term, plus h bar. There was a factor 1 half. There is this factor that I will perhaps discuss a little bit later, but for the moment let us keep writing that way. And then I have a sum of terms which comes from the extension of this, and if I write it carefully, I have a sum over k from k equal 1 to infinity of h bar. I have a factor 1 half, so here I have a 1 half. So if you want, I have a 2 to the power
minus k plus 1. I have a factor minus 1 to the power k minus 1 into the same thing k plus 1. I have a factor g to the power k. Okay, so it's a combinatorial factor. And then I have this integral. Integral product of n points from I equal 1 to k points plus d for x I, and then I have g of x 1 minus x 2 phi square of x 2 up to g of x k minus x 1 phi square of x 1. Okay? And now I would like to represent this graphically, because remember this is just an integral of products of propagator addressed with the field, the classical background field we started from. So this, you can represent an integral of a position of points of products of propagator. I can represent this by Feynman diagrams. Can you just put diagrams presentation for this? So, what kind of diagram is this? So, at first I have a point x1, you see? Then I have a propagator going from x1 to x2. Okay? Then I have a factor phi square of x2, and let me represent a little bit. Let me represent this. This object. I represent the fact that I have a phi 2 here and a phi 2 here, but they are just attached to the same point x2 by some line, but it's not a propagator, so I just represent it like that. So remember, in the Feynman diagram representation, this between two points represents g of x minus y, and in fact this line with a bar here means simply delta of x1 minus x minus y. So it's just a delta function. It means that the field is at a point which is equal to the point x2. You see? Okay. Always a bit confusing, so let me okay. Then I have a g of x2 minus x3. Then I have two other phi attached to this point, the phi x3, and I go on. And at the end, I end up with xk and 2 phi. So you see, okay. So basically, these are the one loop diagrams of the Michael theory with what is called amputated external legs. Amputated means that instead of having a propagator coming out from this vertex of the phi 4 theory, I have an amputated propagator, which is just a delta function. So this is the ordinary propagator. And this is the amputated propagator. Okay. The amputated propagator is just the propagator associated, so it's just the internal kernel associated, which is equal to 1, so it's just the internal kernel of the operator identity. Okay? And therefore, in fact, you see that the one loop, the term of order h bar in the effective actions contains the contribution of all the diagrams at one loop for the 5-4 theory. You see?
So in particular, what is it? And let me rewrite it, for instance. Let me rewrite the first term now in a very, very compact way. And in fact, I can use even a simple notation by introducing what something which will be called the doubly, the two times amputated propagator, okay, which is just the internal kernel of the differential operator minus Laplacian plus m squared. You see, so the propagator is just the internal kernel of 1 over minus delta plus m squared. If I multiply this by minus delta plus m squared, I get the identity, therefore the amputated propagator. If I remultiply the identity by minus Laplacian plus m squared, I get the integral kernel of the operator minus delta plus m squared, and I represent it by the propagator with two lines instead of having one line, you see. And then I get a very simple graphical interpretation of gamma of phi, because the classical action can be represented by two terms. So this is a classical action. This is a phi times an amputated amputated propagator times phi. So I can represent this by a phi, two phi joined by the amputated propagator. This is just a graphical way to represent the action for the free field. The action for this is just G over 4 times the propagator, where I have 4 phi, but they sit at the same place and we integrate over x. So this is simply a vertex of the phi 4 theory with 4 phi field attached to this vertex with amputated lines. So this is just a graphical representation to represent the integral over the position of a vertex of phi 4 of x. This is the factorial 4. So this is a classical term. And then I get the this contribution. And if I write this contribution, the term of order h bar, first I have these terms that I won't discuss. But these terms, I can represent it. I will represent it by a factor minus 1/2 times a closed line. That's a way to represent. It's just a graphical representation for this. I define this to be minus 1/2 times a closed propagator with no vertex. So it's just just a new diagram. Okay? And then I have the terms which starts to be there. And first I have an edge, so I have a G, I have a factor 1/2. And what is the first term? The first term here is just integral over d4x, g of x minus x. So it is just this diagram where I have a phi and I have an amputated diagram phi. So that's a way, that's just the graphical way to represent phi squared of x, d4x, the Feynman propagator, which starts and ends at the same point. You see? And I have a factor 1/2 coming from the fact that here, oh, there is a factor 1/4, sorry, because here I have k equal 1, so I have 1/4, minus 1 to the power 0, and g to the power 1. Okay? And then, what is the second term? The second term is of order g squared. There is a factor minus 1. There is a factor 1 over 8. Oh, and there is a factor k. Sorry, I'm very, very sorry. There is this factor 1 over k here. So there is a factor 1 over 16. And now I have this diagram, phi phi, phi phi. And if you continue, you get plus, this is g squared, of course. You have two vertex. Then I have a G4. I have a 1 over, so this is k equals 3. So I have a 1 over 3 times 1 over 2 to the power 4. So 3 times 16 is 48. And then I have a diagram like that. Phi phi, phi phi, phi phi, plus, etc. Okay? And this is G3, of course. I don't know what I am always writing G4. Okay? So you see that this is a diagrammatic way to represent those, this sum with those integrals. And that's a diagrammatic way to represent what is the effective action, which involves only the one particle irreducible diagrams of the phi 4 theory. Yes?
So where did the minus sign there enter in the circle? Minus 1/2.
Pardon?
Is it just
convention?
There was no minus
1/2.
Yeah,
plus. It's a closed loop. You call it minus 1/2 a circle?
Yes.
You call it minus 1/2 of the circle when you just define that closed loop diagram.
Oh, that's, it's just a... It is just a choice of notation. So I am free to write this, to call these diagrams this trace of minus this trace. And I choose a minus simply because here I have a plus sign, here I have a minus sign, here I have a plus sign. So, to be consistent, I put a minus sign here. Okay? But it's just a choice.
Could I not interpret this as the minus sign gives me in the log 1 over the Feynman proper, 1 over the...
Yes, and that so could you can choose that this object, what does it mean? It means that it is the trace of the log of 1 over minus percent squared. Okay? But it's just, I choose to represent this object by the circle. Yes?
Xk plus 1 is equal to x1, does that just come from the...
It comes from the trace. You see? Remember, the trace, it always means that you close your integration of oppositions. Yes?
What does the amputated length mean? Pardon? What does the doubly amputated length mean?
Oh, it's
what
just,
does it mean that they're amputated?
Okay, it just represents this differential operator applied on a field phi and then integrated over x. You see? So, it's just, you know, you have those two terms which looks a little bit strange. And I just choose to represent the free action by a diagram like that. And the trace of the logarithm of this operator, which is already there on the free theory, I choose to represent it by a doubly computed line and part by a silicon, because it's simply a convenient notation, which is consistent with what I did. You see, here I have a diagram like that, and it, so, you have a sum, you see, you have a sum of irreducible diagrams with five fields associated attached to each external point. And each time that I have an external propagator, I decide that, in fact, when the result of the calculation tells me that I have to replace the propagator by a delta function, namely, I have to compute it. So you see in particular that this object is just two, each time that I have the two particles in every given diagram, I decide that I need to put the left leg and the right leg. Okay? But in particular, the term associated, this is the trivial, the first diagram is in the two-point function, but it has a single leg. The left leg and the right leg are the same. So if I decide that my rule is that each time that I have an external leg, I computed it by replacing, by applying the differential operator minus Laplacian plus m squared to the external legs, it seems that it means that I have computed the right part of the leg. I have to computate the left part of the leg, which gives me precisely this object, which is the integral kernel of this object. So you see that this diagrammatic is consistent, and that's all what I need. All what I need. Okay, so I will end up here this discussion, but I wanted to present this calculation in full detail so that you can see that at one loop, so this is the result which is of course true at one loop, namely at first order in x bar. And so you see that the classical action can be represented as the sum of irreducible diagrams with no loop. There are only two diagrams. The effective action at first order h-bar is given by the sum of all irreducible diagrams with one loop. And in fact, and that's a non-trivial result, this is a result which is valid at all loops, at all orders in h-bar. So in fact, if you work more, this requires much more work, but it's doable, it's a good exercise, and you want to compute the term of order h bar squared in the effective action using the functional integral definition of the effective action, you end up with a sum of irreducible two-loop diagrams. And I remember that I showed you on Friday and Thursday on the slides, example of diagrams which are irreducible, which are two loops. Those are precisely those diagrams which contribute. Okay? Yes?
Do we know what this function is? Which function? Specifically? The one loop. Do we know this function?
This function? Yes. I'm going into that just now. Okay. So I will end up the discussion. So this is a discussion about what is the combinatorics and the structure in space and time of the perturbation expansion. See? And I wanted to explain that because the effective action is something which is very important in many areas in quantum field theory and statistical physics. We shall use it when discussing renormalization tomorrow. And I think Michael Peskin will use it, and it's used, it pops up everywhere. Because it's a basic object which contains already all the information about the physics. If you know the effective action, you know the irreducible diagrams, and you can reconstruct the connected diagrams out of the irreducible one, then you can reconstruct all the amplitudes given by the sum of connected and disconnected diagrams out of the connected diagrams. Out of the amplitudes, you can reconstruct what are, for instance, the diffusion amplitude in collision processes. And therefore, you can reconstruct all the physics, at least all the physics given by perturbation theory in a quantum field theory out of the effective action. And the effective action is a quantity which contains the minimal number of terms and of Feynman diagrams. You see? Okay. So we can...
Pardon? Could you say something about the circle, the closed circle that you don't want to talk about?
Well, the closed circle is given by this amplitude. And, I prefer to wait a little bit. Because I can discuss this amplitude, but at the same time that I discuss this integral and this integral. It's better to discuss them together. Okay, so, now, this ends up the discussion about the structure of perturbation theory. And now, we have to start to discuss really the physics which is contained in this object. Namely, we have to discuss
the what are called the Feynman amplitudes, and the short distance or high energy momentum singularities. Yes? Someone asked a question.
No. Okay. So let us come back to the. So you see everywhere pops up this propagator that I wrote. The propagator is in Euclidean space. Remember, I'm switched back to Euclidean space. It's the integral over 2, 4, k over 2, 5, k, e, I, k plus 6, k squared plus n squared, where k is a four-dimensional momentum vector. Yes?
We get some expanding in the radius for Feynman diagrams. How do you know what is the prefactor that?
Ah, okay. The prefactor I got here, I got it from the just for the expansion of the logarithm.
Yes, but I know for higher loops.
Well, for higher loops, you can compute it by a whole calculation. The point is that this factor is precisely the symmetry factor associated to those.
But that one symmetry factor should be one half.
Right. Here there is a one half, but remember I am integrating over all the two external points, the 2,5. So you can also switch the 2,5. Mm-hmm. So you have an additional symmetry if the position here and the position here are dummy variables. You integrate over. Since they are dummy variables, you can interaction there. If you specify that this is x1, this is x2, then you cannot action them because you have fixed them. So there is an additional symmetry factor here, which is the factor 1/2. Here you can exchange rows, and exchange this, so there is a 1/8. Here you can exchange rows, and make permutation of the vertices, so there is a more complicated vertices. Once you take this into account, all these numbers are just the symmetry factors. So, either you compute them by just ball calculation, or you use the combinatory proofs and say and ask what is the symmetry factor of the diagram, what is the symmetry group, internal symmetry group, and what is the number of elements, and you get the same results. And at one, not only at one loop, but at any order, everything works fine. Okay, so let us go back to this object.
This object is in fact a very singular object because you might be interested in what's going on when x, the modulus of x, goes to zero. Yes?
How many dimensions are we in?
We are in four dimensions. Okay, we are in four dimensions, but I can extend it in
D dimension, I'm sorry, yes. So going, I go to D dimensions of space-time. And it's easy to see that all what I did in four dimension is exactly the same in D dimension. So by now my vector X is a vector with X0, X1, XD minus 1. And everything was fine. So K is also a vector with K naught, K1, K, D minus 1. Okay? And the formula is always the same. And I am interested in what's going on when X goes to 0. And when X goes to 0, you realize that looking at what's happening when X goes to 0 is equivalent to see at what's happening when the momentum K goes to infinity, because it's a Fourier transform. And when K goes to infinity, the term k squared is dominant with respect to m squared. So you can forget about the fact that there is a mass. And this equation, this integral is an integral which is in fact an integral of something which is homogeneous of in k. So you see that this, the dimension of x in k is d4, it has a dimension k to the power d minus 2. So it has a dimension of a length. Length is x to the power 2 minus, yes, 2 minus d. So when x goes to 0, this behaves like some coefficient which depend on d that I won't write here, x to the power 2 minus d. You see? So you see that as soon as d is larger than 2, it's infinite at x equals 0. Okay? And in fact, at d equal 2, there is a logarithm of 1 over x, which appears. In fact, the mass, you have to remember that there is a mass, so that this is dimensionless, and there is a factor, and I don't remember if the factor is 2 pi or pi. I think it's 2 pi, but I'm not completely sure. So basically, it's also infinite in two dimensions. You see? So this is a big problem for the theory, because you see, for instance, at first, that's this amplitude, this diagram, okay, this diagram, which was g of 0, is infinite, in fact. So you already, in this simple term at one loop, you get something which is infinite. You see? Okay. If you think about this term also, this is infinite as soon as the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 2. You see? Now, if you think about what is the contribution of this term, the contribution of this diagram, okay, you have a point x1, you have a point x2, and somewhere you have to integrate over the position of the point x2, g of x1 minus x2 squared. You see? So if I decide that this is something that I call z, for instance, I have an integral which is of the form, I'm sorry, and I am in d dimension now. I have an integral of the form d of z, where z is a d-dimensional vector, and then I have a vector of the form which behaves like modulus of z to the power 4 minus 2 times the dimension. You see? And there is a divergence at 0, at z equals 0, as soon as the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 4. Because when the dimension is 4, I have a d4z divided by z to the power 4. So I have a logarithmic divergence here. So you see so that this object is problematic when d is larger or equal to 2, and the contribution of this diagram is problematic when the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 4. Yes? No? Just okay? Okay. So, where does this come from? Why? And I want, before discussing the mass of this object, show you in a very pictorial way why there are such singularities. So such singularity means that when you are computing the vacuum expectation value of a product of two fields operator in the vacuum, this becomes infinite when x become close to y. This means that the fluctuation of a quantum field, the quantum fluctuation of a field, are very, very singular at short distance. Okay? And I want to show you this on a simple picture. Oops. Okay. So, okay, so what I want to show you is I want to show you in the functional integral. Remember that all the quantization can be defined out of a functional integral where we sum about, we are averaging over field configuration. Okay? And I'm asking what is a typical field configuration which occurs in the functional integral? You see? So I will consider what are the typical configurations for the free field, namely the field where there are no interactions, so it's the free field we studied last week, and in addition, the massless free field, because I am interested into the properties at short distance, and the mass term is not important at short distance. So it is the massless free field configuration. Okay. And first, remember, what you did with Ben Schumacher and what I did in the first lecture was to discuss just the quantum mechanical problem. The quantum mechanical problem is a problem where you have time, but you have no space. Well, of course, you have space, but space is just the value of the field because you have, do not have any relativistic invariance. So, in fact, quantum mechanics is a quantum field theory with one dimension of time and no dimension of space in the sense of a space which is connected to the time by doing Lorentz transformation. Okay, so in a one-dimensional space-time, which is just time, what is the what are the typical field configuration? Of course, it's not working there. Oops. Okay, so I have to go. Ah, there it is. It went. Ah, two. Okay. Yes. Okay. So here is one. One field configuration. So this is so here I represented the origin. It's a classical trajectory, and this is a typical trajectory in the Feynman path integral formalism, which goes from the one point at time zero to another point at time t. And you see, it's a very, very wiggled configuration. And in fact, it is a Brownian motion. It's something probably you have seen that in the lecture by Leo Kadanoff. It's something which is very well known in statistical physics and very well known in mathematics. It's just what is called a Brownian motion, or in probability, a Wiener process. Yes?
Is it just a coincidence that it ends up at the same point it started?
That it ends up with?
It ends up at the same point it started. Is that a coincidence?
I'm sorry, the same what?
It ends at the same place that it started.
Oh, no, so that's because I choose a point, a random walk, which is conditioned so that it ends up at a given point. Okay. So if you are a bit familiar with probability theory, it's not called the Brownian walk. Well, Brownian walk is just you specify the point it starts, whatever. It's called the Brownian bridge because you choose a Brownian walk which answers specifically at a certain point. So it's a condition random walk. Okay? And you see that a random walk is a path which is continuous. You see something which is continuous. It has a lot of wiggles. So, in fact, it has no derivative. The derivative of a Brownian walk is not well defined as a mathematical object because the speed of the particle fluctuates very, very widely. So the instantaneous speed is always infinite. Nevertheless, it's a function which is continuous. Okay? And, yes?
A particular choice of timing of integral, right?
Pardon?
Well, there was a particular interval you chose, a small interval for.
Oh yes, of course. I choose a very small interval of time, but the interval is perhaps 10 to the minus 3 or minus 4. So it's smaller than the pixel on the picture. So with the resolution of the pixel of the screen, it's really a 1 over. Okay. Okay. So here are. Yes, there are several on the board, so that's a set of
typical configuration in the Feynman path integral, you see. And now let us do the same thing for a free field in two dimensions. Okay? So here is a free Gaussian field in two dimensions. So this is the time, Euclidean time dimension, and this is a spatial time. And here I have chosen a number of steps of my space-time, which is 64 by 64. So, in fact, the resolution where I am looking my free field is much coarser than the resolution of the pixel of the screen. So I have a discretized time and a discretized space. And you see that it's something which looks also quite irregular as a Brownian walk. Okay. But now what's interesting is look it at higher and higher resolution. And if you go to higher and higher resolution, here I double the resolution, and you see that it starts to be very, very irregular. In particular, you see that, in fact, the amplitudes are growing larger. And if I go to higher dimension, to higher resolution, okay, here it is. The resolution is 4 times larger. Here the resolution is, well, starts to be of the order of the screen resolution. And you see that it's a very, very irregular object. You see? And in fact, it's not a continuous object. If you are at one point and you make a little step, you can start here and end up here. So in fact, a typical configuration in the functional integral for the free field is in fact not a continuous function. It's an object. It's not only a function with no derivative, it's a function which is not really continuous. So it's not really a function. And in fact, mathematicians know very well how to characterize it. It's a distribution. So it's a combination of delta function, of derivative of delta function, of derivative of derivatives of delta function. It's a mixture of that. It's a very, very irregular object that we know how to deal it with the math. But it's very difficult to visualize it. Yes?
You can define a derivative for distributions, though. So, you said earlier that you can still define a derivative on distribution.
Yes.
So you say it's not true. There's no derivative, but there is a derivative.
No, but the derivative is not a continuous or well-behaved function. You see. It's a distribution. Its derivative is a distribution, etc. But it's a very irregular object. But still, one can do math with it. We started to do math, and mathematicians know how to do very serious and clean math out of it. But those are not functions. Okay? And now. Okay, so now I do the same thing in three dimensions. So in three dimensions, it's very difficult, at least for me, to make a snapshot of the configuration of the field living in three-dimensional space. So I just cut, imagine that you have your three-dimensional space, and I made a cut along the horizontal, it becomes a two-dimensional cut, and now I plot how the field configuration looks like in a two-dimensional cut on a slice of space. And of course, since the problem will be invariant by rotation, it's not really important if I take a slice like that, or like that, or like that, or like that. Okay. So this is the aspect of the field on a two-dimensional section, a two-dimensional slice of three-dimensional space. And it's quite similar if I use a low resolution, but if I go to higher resolution, you see that it's quite similar. Yes. And in fact, if you compare more carefully the two, you realize that in fact this field configuration is very irregular, that like the one in two dimensions, but in fact it is much more irregular at short distance. And it's much more irregular precisely because what we wrote, what I wrote here. Because the correlation function between the field at two neighboring points, in two dimensions, it's divergent, but it diverges like the logarithm of the distance, while in three dimensions, it diverges like the distance between the two points. So you see that field configuration phi is in the integral d over phi are very irregular at short distances, and the higher d is, the dimension of space-time, the more irregular they are. And these irregularities of the quantum field at short distance is contained in this scaling law. Okay. And it is. And it's a problem which it's not a problem, in fact. Well, it's a mathematical problem for us if we want to define a quantum field theory, but it's not a problem with a quantum field theory. It's a feature of quantum field theory. Because it's something which will be there in every quantum theory defined in space-time if you want to enforce relativistic invariance. In particular, here I have shown that there is a singularity in Euclidean space. But in fact, this problem, let us now go back to Minkowski space, because after all, we are here to do real physics. In Euclidean space, if I am considering this phi of x, let us phi of 0, for instance, okay, here is my two-dimensional space-time. This is x0, this is x1. Okay, and I have a singularity here. You see? You have a singularity at 0. There is this singularity. Okay? If I am going back to Minkowski space-time, now I am considering the same function, in fact, computed by analytic continuation using the Vick rotation that we discussed. Now I am computing the expectation value in the vacuum of the theory of the time ordered product of two filed operators, one located at the origin and the other one at x. So now this is x1, this is the space dimension, this is time, which is x0. This function, in fact, now, it's a Feynman propagator, so it has, it behaves differently in the space, in the past region, and in the future region, because there is a light cone. We know that here, you have a singularity here along the light cone. You have causal singularity, which means, for instance, that the Feynman propagator is real for space like intervals, but it has an imaginary part for time like intervals simply because of causality, because those two operators commute. If I have an operator here at 0 and an operator here at a point x, if 0 and x are causally separated, those operators commute. While if x lies in the future or in the past of 0,
those operators do not commute, and their commutator is proportional to I times something, so they must have an imaginary part. Therefore, there are singularities which correspond to the causal structure of space-time. Okay? So you have singularities for the Feynman propagator, but those singularities are just related to the physics of causality. But you still have a singularity here. This singularity, which is this short distance, short time, space singularity, which is the same as the singularity here that I discussed in Euclidean spacetime. So this singularity is a real singularity. It tells you that the correlation functions of quantum operator in spacetime have a behavior which is special when you go to very, very short interval, both in space and time. So you can go that way, you get a singularity. You can go that way, you get a singularity. You can go that way, you get also a singularity. You see? Okay. So, these singularities are called usually, in fact, I denoted it by singularity at short distance or high energy, but they are usually denoted as ultraviolet singularities. And usually, ultraviolet is contracted into the acronym UV, as usual in physics, singularities. Okay, ultraviolet just comes from the original physics of... people discover those singularities when studying electrodynamics, so the physics of photon, and not the physics of the scalar field, but the physics of a quantized Maxwell field. And a Maxwell field with high momenta or high energy is light in the ultraviolet region, where for small momenta or large distance, you are in the infrared region, hence the denomination. Okay? So everywhere in physics book discussing quantum physics theory, you will meet this acronym ultraviolet, which do not mean at all that we are looking at quanta with a de Broglie wavelength of the order of some tenths of a micron. It's just that we are going in a very high energy domain. So ultraviolet usually means, for instance, of the order of the TeV or of the order of the Planck mass. Okay, so I end up there today, thank you. And tomorrow we shall discuss more. We shall see that there is a lot of structure in this short distance divergence. So in fact, those singularities contains a lot of physics about what is a quantum field. And this physics can be used to deal with the apparent divergence that I discussed here, which are in the quantities that are present in perturbative calculation in quantum physics theory. So in fact, those divergences are the signal that we must be much more careful when defining what is perturbation theory in a quantum field theory, and that's called the process of renormalization in defining a quantum field theory. Okay, so thank you. Yes?
Any questions?
Yes.
Is that formula you boxed there for the integral dz? Should that 2 be multiplying with E?
There?
Like middle of the board.
Yes.
Divergence at z equals 0 as soon as d is bigger than equal to 4?
Yes.
Don't you have it at d is equal to 2 in that formula?
No, because in fact, this is integral. You can use radial coordinates. So if here is like d z from 0 to something, z to the power d minus 1, times z to the power 4 minus 0. Yes. And z to the power 3 minus 0. You see that this is equal to, we get the dz times z, which is perfectly well defined in the world, on 0.
So
it's 4 equals 4.
There's something that's in
the book. Yeah. Is there another book that
goes along? Maybe it's in just a... Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Could you imagine?
You should ask for some.
Is it in the book or...